response to a stimulus like the bear, or, as I was beginning to notice in clinic, a nurse with a needle. MRI studies of severely maltreated kids from Romanian orphanages shows dramatic enlargement of their amygdalae. The other thing that happens when the amygdala is chronically or repeatedly activated is that it starts messing up its predictions about what's scary and what's not. The amygdala begins sending false alarms to the other parts of your brain about things that shouldn't actually be scary, just like the little boy who cried wolf. I don't know karate, but I do know crazy, a.k.a. the locus coeruleus. This part of the brain is the driving force behind aggressive behavior. Sorry, Raiders fans, I'm still looking at you. It works closely with the prefrontal cortex, which is why we see overlap in how they both regulate impulse control. The dysregulated locus coeruleus releases too much noradrenaline, the brain's version of adrenaline, and can result in increased anxiety, arousal, and aggression. It can also seriously mess with your sleep-wake cycles by overloading your system with hormones that tell it to remain vigilant because, hello, a bear is in your cave. The conductor, a.k.a. the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal cortex, PFC, sits right behind your forehead in the front part of your brain. Unlike the amygdala, which is thought to be a very primitive structure, the PFC is believed to be one of the last to have evolved, and it confers faculties of reason, judgment, planning, and decision-making. It is often referred to as the seat of executive functioning, which is the ability to differentiate among conflicting thoughts and inputs, consider future consequences of current activities, work towards a defined goal, and exhibit social control. That is, suppress urges that, if not suppressed, lead to socially unacceptable outcomes. In many ways, it's like the conductor of an orchestra, setting the tempo and volume for each of the different players, harmonizing all their inputs into something that is coherent and beautiful, not chaotic and loud. Think about your average day in a fifth grade classroom. The teacher is talking. The kid beside you is throwing a wad of paper across the room. Your arch nemesis is kicking you ferociously under the table. And the girl you like just passed you a note telling you that she doesn't like you anymore. That's a lot for a normally functioning PFC to deal with. For kids with toxic stress, the activity of the prefrontal cortex is inhibited in two ways. First, the overactive amygdala sends messages to the PFC, telling it to decrease its functioning because something scary is happening. You don't want reason getting in the way of survival. The second is that the locus coeruleus is flooding the brain with noradrenaline, compromising the ability to override instincts and impulses. The PFC is the part of the kid's brain that puts the brakes on impulses and helps him or her make smarter decisions. Telling a kid to sit still, concentrate, and ignore stimuli that are flooding his brain with the need to act is a lot to ask. This downregulation of the PFC can have different consequences for different people. For some, it results in an inability to concentrate and solve problems. But in others, it manifests as impulsive behavior and aggression. Memory bank, a.k.a. the hippocampus. The hippocampi are two cute little seahorse-shaped parts of the brain responsible for creating and maintaining memory. When the amygdala gets activated during a major stress event, it sends signals to the hippocampus that disrupt its ability to knit together neurons, essentially making it more difficult for the brain to create both short-term and long-term memories. On brain scans of patients with Alzheimer's disease, the hippocampi are badly damaged. Knowing that, it's pretty obvious why this part of the brain is so critical to learning, and it's easy to see how kids with quick-trigger amygdalae are behind the eight ball when it comes to everything from memorizing multiplication tables to spatial memory. Vagus, baby, a.k.a. the ventral tegmental area, VTA. If the locus coeruleus is a Raiders fan, then the VTA region of the brain is Las Vegas, responsible for things like rewards, motivation, and addiction. This part of the brain is the one you really don't want running away with your credit card. Basically, it all boils down to dopamine, which is the feel-good or feel-amazing neurotransmitter that peppers your brain with rewards when you have sex, shoot heroin, or say yes to that piece of triple chocolate cake at the end of the day. When your stress response system is overloaded again and again, it messes with the sensitivity of your dopamine receptors. You need more and more of the good stuff to feel the same amount of pleasure. The biological changes in the VTA that lead people to crave dopamine stimulators, like high-sugar, high-fat foods, also lead to an increase in risky behavior. The ACE study shows that there is a dose-response relationship between ACE exposure and engaging in many of the activities and substances that activate the VTA. A person with four or more ACEs is 2.5 times as likely to smoke, 5.5 times as likely to be dependent on alcohol, and 10 times as likely to use IV drugs as a person with zero ACEs. So for anyone looking to prevent young folks from developing dependencies on bad-for-you dopamine stimulators like cigarettes and alcohol, understanding that exposure to early adversity affects the way dopamine functions in the brain is an absolute must. Hormonal harmony. Ladies, have you ever noticed that the 1 month you are sweating about whether you're going to get your period is the month that it seems to come late? Well, it's not just your imagination. Due to the impact it has on the hormonal systems, the stress response can affect everything from menstrual cycles to libidos to waistlines. Hormones are the body's chemical messengers, responsible for kicking off a wide range of biological processes. Big ones include growth, metabolism, how your body gets and stores energy from food, sexual function, and reproduction. So, basically, everything. The hormonal system is very sensitive to the stress response, which makes sense, because when you see the bear in the woods, it's hormones that get the party started. Adrenaline, cortisol, go! Just about every one of the body's hormonal systems is affected by stress. Growth hormones, sex hormones including estrogen and testosterone, thyroid hormone, and insulin, which regulates blood sugar, all tend to decrease during stress. Some of the major health impacts are dysfunction of the ovaries and testes, also known as gonads, psychosocial short stature, and obesity. In the case of gonadal dysfunction, for women, this can lead to not ovulating, not having a period, or menstrual irregularity. In one study, researchers found that 33% of newly incarcerated women with stress, can you imagine a newly incarcerated woman who doesn't have stress, had irregular periods. Psychosocial short stature is what we saw with Diego, severe delay of growth in children and adolescents due to a pathological environment. In some cases, children have severely reduced levels of growth hormone. But other times, as we saw with Diego, growth hormone isn't measurably decreased. In these cases, we believe the disruption comes from other factors that help growth hormone do its job. Obesity is a much more familiar foe, but in the hormonal system, we see a double whammy. As I mentioned above, because of its impact on the pleasure center, the VTA, chronic stress increases your cravings for high-sugar, high-fat foods. And elevated cortisol makes it harder for your body to metabolize sugars and easier for your body to store fat. But cortisol isn't the only bad guy here. The hormones leptin and ghrelin are also increased with the activation of the stress response. Together, they intensify appetite and work with cortisol to do their worst for your waistline. The chart review that we did at the clinic showed us that if a kid had an ACE score of 4 or more, he or she was twice as likely to be overweight or obese as a child with 0 ACEs. This is where we see how biology and social determinants of health collide with significant consequences. We've talked about how kids living in vulnerable communities have a lot of intersecting risks driving ill health. Lack of access to good health care, few safe places to play, and food insecurity do contribute to striking health disparities in places like Bayview. But our patients with 0 ACEs lived in the same neighborhood and had the same access to health care, the same lack of safe places to play and nutritious food as our patients with high ACEs. When you realize what toxic stress does to the hormonal systems of kids who have experienced multiple ACEs, you understand that it's not just because they subsist primarily on a diet of fast food that they're overweight. It's not just that they're living in a food desert, a term that refers specifically to a neighborhood with a dearth of nutritious food, and are being brought up by parents who think that Taco Bell is a healthier alternative to McDonald's. Those things compound the problem, to be sure, but they're not the whole story. Our data suggested how powerful the underlying mechanism of toxic stress can be, that the metabolic disruption was also an important driver. If you grow up in a food desert, of course it's going to be difficult for you to be healthy. But if you also have higher cortisol levels that are driving you to crave high-sugar, high-fat foods, it's going to be that much harder for you to choose broccoli over French fries. Foreign relations, toxic stress, and the immune system. Immunology was by far my most painful class in medical school, which is ironic considering that the immune system should be the doctor's best friend. The problem is the intricacy of it all. The immune system wields a lot of power. It is responsible for monitoring the relationships between what's inside and what's outside in the world, and also for defending the body against foreign threats. Kind of like your own personal Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense rolled into one. Because the body has so many different antagonists and so many different allies, sometimes it's hard to tell them apart. The immune system has to be an expert on all of it, knowing, for instance, that the protein on the outside of a bacteria or virus is bad and the microbe needs to be fought off, but also that the proteins in the lungs, nerves, and blood cells are good and should be left alone. When the body's secretaries are pleased with foreign relations, they're very low-key. They quietly go about the business of maintaining order by constantly scanning the body for cells that are infected, injured, or becoming cancerous. And when they find them, they destroy them. When a bad guy manages to evade the routine defenses and cause disease, the Secretary of Defense sounds the alarm, marshaling armies and launching strategic attacks. The immune system uses chemical signals called cytokines to activate your body's response to injury or illness. The word cytokine literally means cell movers. They prod your body to make more white blood cells, which fight off infection and activate different types of cells to do things like make antibodies and eat bacteria. The immune system also stimulates inflammation, like when a bug bite gets all red and swollen. Like everything else in the body, what's important in the immune system is balance. Dysregulation of the stress response has a profound impact on immune and inflammatory responses because virtually all the components of the immune system are influenced by stress hormones. Chronic exposure to stress hormones can suppress the immune system in some ways and activate it in others. And unfortunately, none of it's good. Stress can lead to deficiency in the part of the immune system that fights off the common cold, tuberculosis, and certain tumors. In Sweden, researcher Jerker Karlén and his colleagues found that kids with three or more exposures to early stress showed increases in cortisol levels and were more likely to be affected by common childhood health issues such as upper respiratory infections, colds, gastroenteritis, stomach flu, and other viral infections. We also know that dysregulation of the stress response can lead to increased inflammation, hypersensitivity, think allergies, eczema, and asthma, and even autoimmune disease when the immune system attacks the body itself, as with Trinity's Graves' disease. In the years since the ACE study was first released, scientists have looked closely at the relationship between ACEs and autoimmune disease. Research findings show a strong correlation between childhood stress and autoimmune disease in both children and adults. In partnership with Dr. Felitti and Dr. Onda, researcher Shanta Dubey analyzed the data of over 15,000 ACE study participants, looking at their ACE score and how often they were hospitalized for autoimmune diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, type 1 diabetes, celiac disease, and idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. What Dubey found was striking. A person with an ACE score of 2 or more had twice the odds of hospitalization for autoimmune disease as someone with 0 ACEs. Just as the brain or the nervous system is not fully developed when a child is born, the immune system is also still developing well after birth. In fact, when babies are first born, they have very little functioning immunity, something that will develop with time with a little help from their moms. Breastfeeding is so important, in part because mom's antibodies protect the baby from infection and help grow his immune system. If you've ever wondered why people are hesitant to bring very young babies out into the world, that's why. Well, that and the soul-crushing sleep deprivation. A baby's immune development occurs in response to his or her environment over the course of the first years of life. Think about it as the Secretary of State in her first year in office, still meeting all the foreign heads of state, feeling out who's hostile and who's friendly. Unfortunately, getting a good read on the reality of the threat is difficult when there's an adrenaline and cortisol overload. This kind of disruption early on in development can lead to lifelong alterations in the function of the immune system and, in many cases, to disease. Think of it like this. If the Secretary of Defense is triggered to send in the troops to fight invaders in the body, sometimes the troops will attack the right enemies, but sometimes they'll find trouble where trouble doesn't exist. The more inflammation there is in the body, the greater the chance that some of that inflammation will attack the body's own tissues, leading to autoimmune disease, like rheumatoid arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease, and multiple sclerosis. Because early adversity increases inflammation, When you have higher numbers of troops roaming around the body, there's a greater likelihood that they'll make a mistake. Researchers in Dunedin, New Zealand, demonstrated that the changes in levels of inflammation were actually measurable. They followed a group of 1,000 people over the course of 30 years, observing and recording a number of important health data points over that time. In addition to reinforcing Felitti and Onda's findings, the Dunedin researchers discovered that even 20 years after their subjects had been maltreated as children, 4 different markers of inflammation were higher than they were in those who hadn't been maltreated. What makes this study a critical addition to the research on ACEs is that the patients' adverse childhood events had been reported as they were happening, strengthening the case for causality by documenting that the adversity preceded the biological harms. We know that a well-balanced immune system is critical to good health. When we realize that adversity in childhood harms the development and regulation of the immune system throughout someone's life, we begin to understand just how powerful the ACE science can be to combat some of the leading causes of disease and death. For me, the immune system piece of the ACE puzzle was important because I found that when people learned how toxic stress affects the immune system, they listened in a different way. It's counter to the story they may already have in their heads. People seem to know that if you eat too much, you mess around with your hormones and gain weight. And if you make impulsive decisions or become addicted to alcohol, you'll affect your neurological system. But it's harder to connect those perceived human failings to something like Graves' disease or multiple sclerosis. Most people don't think about those conditions as being caused by anything other than genetic bad luck. What is so powerful about the follow-up ACE studies, like the one Dubay did, is that they show a strong correlation between autoimmune disease and exposure to something environmental and specific, childhood adversity. Dr. Felitti's patient Patty is a perfect example of why it's important to pay attention to those correlations. Patty was extremely obese and also had some psychological and emotional problems. The sleep eating is the tip-off here. Even for those who know that abuse often leads to emotional problems and sometimes to obesity, those issues might seem like the beginning and end of the impact of adversity on her life. But when we see that Patty actually died of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, an autoimmune disease, the odds of which increase with the number of ACEs a person has, the plot thickens. The consequences of toxic stress are not just neurologic and hormonal. They're also immunologic. And those symptoms are much more difficult to spot. Patty's childhood adversity threatened her immune system as much as it did her mental well-being. The problem was that, for Patty, no one suspected that her immune system could be fatally compromised because of toxic stress. No one knew where to look. My understanding of how early adversity affected my patients had come farther in the past 12 months than it had in the previous decade. Yet the picture wasn't quite complete. It made sense to me that an overactive stress response could do a lot of harm to someone's health. I felt I understood clearly how the changes to the neuroendocrine immune systems could lead to problems for my kids. But the ACE study also showed that adversity in childhood could lead to health problems decades later. By that time, many people would have escaped the challenging conditions of their childhood. So why was Dr. Felitti seeing the same or arguably worse problems in his patients? How was it that ACEs were the gift that kept on giving? I had a niggling sense that the blueprint of the toxic stress Death Star went one dimension deeper, drawn in even fainter lines. I knew these questions would take me even farther down the rabbit hole of toxic stress, but I had come this far, and I had to find out how it worked on the deepest level of all, genetics. Chapter 6. Lick Your Pups. Parents of very young babies come into my clinic displaying all the different colors of the emotional rainbow. Exhausted, elated, concerned, proud, terrified. So when Charlene brought her daughter, Nia, in to see me, Charlene's complete lack of facial expression stood out. When I asked this young mother a question about her daughter, she would respond, but her face and eyes stayed flat. It was almost as if we were talking about what size shoe she wore or what time the number 22 bus would arrive. Otherwise, she could have been any early 20-something mom with an infant. She was snugly tucked into her jeans and wore a cute blouse with her hair pulled back neatly. 5-month-old Nia, however, was not typical. When Charlene was pregnant with her, Nia had stopped growing and had to be delivered by emergency C-section 8 weeks early. At birth, she had clocked in at a mere 3 pounds. After weeks in the hospital, Nia improved nicely and was released in good health. But in the weeks that followed at home, she had struggled to gain weight. As I worked with my team and Charlene to figure out the cause, I became increasingly concerned. We spent hours walking Charlene through how to prepare food for her daughter, when to feed her, and how much to give her. We took Nia's vitals and did blood work. We watched her weight and height measurements like mission control for the space shuttle launch. Moving beyond her characteristic flatness, she would quickly become annoyed and overwhelmed when her daughter would cry or fuss. She'd tell her to shut up or ignore her completely. It looked to me like a clear case of postpartum depression, but no amount of urging could convince Charlene to get help. Eventually, Nia's health became critical, and we were out of options. She was suffering from failure to thrive, a medical term that describes babies who don't gain enough weight and eventually can't meet their developmental milestones. Every second in the first years of life, over 1 million new neural connections are formed. So if an infant isn't getting enough fats and proteins needed to make healthy brain connections, that can have significant impacts. I recommended that Nia be hospitalized, hoping that under constant care, she would gain the weight she so desperately needed. Nia spent 4 days in the hospital and did exactly that. But soon after she was released, the gains she made were erased. We redoubled our efforts, bringing in our social worker and trying hard to engage Charlene in treatment. But eventually, we had to send Nia for yet another hospital stay. This time, when I talked to the inpatient team at the hospital, we agreed that it was time to start talking about Child Protective Services, CPS. They were seeing the same problems with Charlene and Nia's dynamic that we were. Charlene was still suffering from depression, and she was still refusing to get help. After Nia was released the second time, she again failed to grow and thrive at home. With a heavy heart, knowing Charlene would be thrown into a tailspin, I had to do something no pediatrician ever wants to do: file a CPS report. I didn't know for sure that Charlene was being overtly neglectful, not feeding Nia or hurting her, but I did know that Nia was way below the third percentile for weight, even when we took into account her prematurity. She was in the danger zone, and it was clear by then that the dynamic between daughter and mom was affecting Nia's growth. In cases like this, it can be hard to parse things out. We know that babies who are born premature are at greater risk of neglect simply because they have greater needs, more irregular sleep patterns, more frequent feedings, and that those needs can be enough to overstress an exhausted new parent. But if an infant doesn't have a caregiver's reciprocal eye contact, stimulating facial expressions, snuggles and kisses, hormonal and neurologic damage can occur. And that can prevent a child from growing and developing normally. When a baby is not being cared for, she doesn't grow well, even if she has enough nutrition. Was Nia's problem that she wasn't getting enough food? Or was it that Charlene was so depressed that she wasn't stimulating Nia? The truth was that it could have been both. Here's where I put my toxic stress lens on the situation. At the tender age of 5 months, with a depressed mom and a dad who wasn't involved, Nia already had two ACEs. I had some strong suspicions that Charlene had an ACE score as well. Despite the initial sadness that I felt at having to file the report and put Charlene under the strict eye of CPS, a major question I'd had before came bubbling up to the surface once again. How is it that ACEs are handed down so reliably from generation to generation? For many families, it seemed that toxic stress was more consistently transmitted from parent to child than any genetic disease I had seen. Take, for example, Cora, a longtime Bayview resident who was the primary caregiver for 10-year-old Tiny, her great-grandson. At 68, Cora had not intended to raise another child, but when the child welfare workers called to say that Tiny's mom was incarcerated and they needed to find a home for the boy, Cora felt torn. Her son, Tiny's grandfather, wasn't capable of caring for a child. Both he and Tiny's grandmother had struggled with addictions to alcohol and other substances, and she had passed away from kidney failure in her late 40s. Now it looked like Tiny's mother would be in prison for a long time. Cora was exhausted. Still, she couldn't let the boy go into the system. Cora brought Tiny in to see me for his regular checkup. Her greatest concern was his behavior. She received calls from the school on a daily basis. Most recently, he had overturned his desk in class, and when the teacher pulled him aside to reprimand him, Tiny had kicked her, earning him a suspension. During the exam, I got a chance to see what Cora was talking about. Most kids are on their best behavior in the doctor's office, so observing Tiny was revealing. He would frequently interrupt, aggressively rip up the exam table's paper to get our attention, and then leap off the table, open drawers, and pull out whatever was inside. At one point, he scooted down on the floor and managed to unplug my computer before I could redirect him. No doubt, staying ahead of Tiny was a workout. Cora and Tiny's visit was in the early days of the Bayview Clinic, back before we were doing regular ACE screening. But I could tell he would need a lot of resources. I excused myself for a moment to knock on Dr. Clark's door for a brief consultation. When I returned to the room, I opened the door in the same way I always did, with a brief knock-knock before I gently swung the door open. The scene that I walked in on stopped me in my tracks. Tiny crouched in the corner, his hands shielding his face from the blows his great-grandmother was raining down on him. Shoulders, head, face, body, Cora was slapping and yelling, really going at him. I almost couldn't believe my eyes Was she seriously beating the child in the doctor's office? Stop, I said forcefully. I crossed the room in two strides and physically inserted myself between them. You are not allowed to hit children in our clinic or anywhere else. I gave Tiny a good once-over to make sure that he wasn't seriously injured. Then I calmly explained to Cora that because I was a mandated reporter, I would have to call CPS. Go on and call him, Cora responded. CPS don't got to raise that baby. I do. He needs to get some act right in him. Otherwise, he gonna end up in the pen just like his mama. It was obvious to me that Cora believed that she was doing the right thing. After watching two generations lose their way, Cora was relying on the tools she had learned in her own upbringing to keep Tiny on the straight and narrow. The irony was that, despite Cora's intentions, the beating was undoubtedly unleashing a neurochemical cascade that made Tiny more likely to end up like his mom and grandparents. That day, I convinced Cora to sit with me as I made the call to CPS. She got a chance to see that I wasn't ratting her out, but rather advocating for her, telling the agency that she needed additional tools to help her manage Tiny's challenging behavior without using violence. Ultimately, she trusted me enough to agree to work with Dr. Clark. The beating stopped, and the family remained intact. For a long time, that interaction with Cora stayed with me. I thought about her and Tiny and the generations in between. I was seeing all around me evidence of multi-generational ACEs. But it was rat mothers and rat pups in landmark studies by Dr. Michael Meany and his colleagues at McGill University that helped me piece together how to understand and ultimately interrupt the biological legacy of toxic stress. Meany and his team looked at two groups of rat mothers and rat pups. They noticed that after the pups were handled by researchers, the moms would soothe their stressed-out pups by licking and grooming them. This is basically the human equivalent of hugs and kisses. What was fascinating was that not all moms did it to the same extent. Some moms exhibited high levels of licking and grooming behavior towards their pups. Other moms displayed low licking and grooming behavior, which meant they didn't give as many sloppy kisses and embarrassing hugs when their pups were having a rough day. Here's the part that made me sit up straight in my chair. Researchers observed that the development of the pup's response to stress was directly affected by whether the mom was a high licker or a low licker. They found that pups of high licker moms had lower levels of stress hormones, including corticosterone, when they were handled by researchers or otherwise stressed out. This high licker leads to low stress effect also showed a dose-response pattern. The more licking and grooming the rat pups got, the lower their levels of stress hormones. In addition, the pups of high licker moms had a more sensitive and effective stress thermostat. By contrast, pups of low lickers not only had higher spikes of corticosterone in response to a stressor, in this case, being placed in restraints for 20 minutes, they also had a harder time shutting off their stress response than did the pups of high licker moms. The licking and grooming behavior that occurred in the pup's first 10 days of life predicted changes to their stress response that lasted for the entire lifetime. Even more startling, the changes continued into the next generation because female pups who had high licker moms became high lickers themselves when they had their own pups. I thought of Charlene and Nia as I read about Meany's work. and I wondered how much licking and grooming Shailene herself had received as a child. She was certainly facing her fair share of stressors. I had witnessed in my residency how frightening it can be to have a premature infant, even for the most well-supported and resilient of parents. When she came through the door of my clinic, Shailene was the young, depressed mother of a premature infant, but she hadn't always been that. Growing up in Bayview, Shailene was full of promise. As a high school soccer star, she seemed to have beaten the odds when her athletic prowess earned her a college scholarship. But a knee injury in her freshman year cut her dreams short. She dropped out the following year, and after a few years at home, she became pregnant. Now she was struggling to care for her baby girl. I worried for both Shailene and Nia. My medical training had taught me how to make the diagnosis of failure to thrive. What I hadn't learned was how to break the intergenerational cycle of toxic stress. I consumed Meanie's research, searching for that all-important mechanism at the source. What the researchers were hoping to discover was how this early behavior could go on to affect the rat's stress response and behavior for the rest of their lives. In other words, these scientists were looking for the root of the change, just like me. What they found was that the rat moms were, in fact, handing down a message to their pups that changed the way their pups' stress responses were wired. But the mechanism, the how of the changes, turned out to be not genetic, but epigenetic. Many people still think of genes and the environment as very separate things. You're born with a certain genetic code that determines your biology and health, and you have experiences that shape more malleable things, like character and values. Keeping genes and environment in separate corners like this has sparked years of debate about which is more important, nature or nurture. People have been arguing over this for a long time, but as the science gets more and more advanced, there's less and less to argue about. Scientists can now say pretty definitively that there's no separating the two. In fact, we now know that both environment and genetic code shape both biology and behavior. Considering how closely genes and environment work together, it's no surprise that the debate raged on for hundreds of years with no winner in sight. Luckily, with advances in science, we're finally able to see that there's a vital synchronicity that determines what we look like, how our bodies work, and ultimately, who we are. Most people know that DNA is the genetic code, the basic blueprint for your biology. To take that understanding a step further, your body uses this code as a template to produce the proteins that make up new cells and ensure that all the things inside those cells function. Every cell has your entire genetic code in it, as well as the machinery to read this code and decide which parts of the sequence to translate into proteins. Environment and experience play a huge role in determining which parts of your genetic code are read and transcribed in each new cell your body creates. How does your experience or environment do that? Well, it turns out that the body doesn't exactly read every word of its DNA. What scientists have discovered is that baked into the cells are both the genome, your entire genetic code, and the epigenome, another layer of chemical markers that sit on top of your DNA and determine which genes get read and transcribed into proteins and which ones don't. The term epigenetic actually means above the genome. These epigenetic markers are handed down from parent to child, along with the DNA. One way to think about it is this. The genome is like the musical notes in sheet music, and the epigenetic markers are like the notations that tell you how loudly, quietly, quickly, or slowly to play the notes. There might be a notation to skip an entire section of music altogether. These epigenetic notations are subject to experience, to being rewritten by your environment. Activation of the stress response is one big way the environment can change epigenetic notations. As your body tries to adapt to the stress of your experiences, it turns certain genes on or off, particularly genes that regulate how you'll respond to stressful events in the future. That process of the epigenome working with the genome to respond to your environment is called epigenetic regulation, and it's critical to our understanding of why toxic stress is so damaging to our lifelong health. When a 4-year-old breaks a bone, that trauma is not encoded in his epigenome. It doesn't affect him in the long term. But when a 4-year-old experiences chronic stress and adversity, some genes that regulate how the brain, immune system, and hormonal systems respond to stress get turned on, and others get turned off. And unless there's some intervention, they'll stay that way, changing the way the child's body works, and in some cases, leading to disease and early death. There are a handful of processes that are responsible for epigenetic regulation. But the two that we know the most about when it comes to the genetics of stress are DNA methylation and histone modification. In DNA methylation, a biochemical marker called a methyl group is attached to the beginning of a DNA sequence. That marker prevents the gene from being turned on. It acts like a do not disturb sign hanging on a hotel doorknob. It tells the DNA housekeeping team not to come in and translate that genetic sequence into proteins, essentially rendering that part of the genetic code silent. Histones are like a chastity belt for the DNA. They're proteins that keep the genetic material locked up, preventing the DNA transcription machinery from getting to it. When certain biochemical markers are attached to the histones are then modified. They change shape and become more open, allowing the DNA to be read and transcribed. Which brings us back to the rat moms and their pups. The Lick Your Pup study is a great example of this type of epigenetic regulation. Meany and his team found that high licker moms were releasing high levels of serotonin in their offspring. You may have heard that serotonin is the body's natural antidepressant. It boosts mood and acts as the equivalent of rat pup Prozac. This serotonin doesn't just make the pups feel better. It also activated a chemical process that changed the transcription of the part of the DNA that regulates the stress response. Meany and his colleagues eventually demonstrated that all that licking and grooming ultimately changed the epigenetic markers on the rat pup's DNA, leading to lifelong changes in the stress response. This kind of epigenetic change is like a communication shortcut for nature. When rat moms don't lick their pups, they're essentially telling them that there's something to be wary about in the environment, so they should be on high alert. Instead of waiting around for the generations-long process of genetic adaptation to change the offspring's DNA, this environmental information gets passed on to the rat pup quickly through a change in the epigenome. To look more closely at this process, the MENI research team did something brilliant. Taking a cue from a Lifetime TV movie, they switched some of the rat pups at birth. They placed pups of high liquor moms with moms who were low liquors, and vice versa. The study found that the pups' DNA methylation took on the pattern of their foster moms, not their genetic moms. So did their behavior. If a rat pup born to a high liquor mom was fostered by a low liquor, she grew up to be an anxious adult rat with high levels of stress hormones, who was also a low liquor herself when she had her own pups. MENI and his team found that the differences in licking and grooming that happened early on, in this case, the first 10 days of a rat pup's life, made a huge difference. To take it one step further, MENI and his colleagues tested whether it was possible to reverse DNA methylation patterns after a rat had reached adulthood. Using tricostatin A, a solution capable of pulling methyl markers off DNA, they devised a way to chemically alter methylation patterns. When they injected the TSA solution into the brains of the adult offspring of the high liquor and low liquor moms, it completely eliminated the changes in the adult rat's stress response. This study was a showstopper for me for a couple reasons. It showed the mechanism of the long-term changes was not simply genetic. The adverse experiences of my Bayview patients were factors that extended down to their DNA and likely changed them epigenetically. MENI's work showed me not only how moms can negatively affect their pups by not licking them enough, but also how they can help them by licking them more. The fact that environment is something we can modify means that there's a lot of hope for pups born to low liquor moms. These pups are not damaged goods. They are not defective. If they can get a safe, stable, and nurturing environment at an early age, the biology says that this sets them up to develop a healthy stress response system in adulthood. As we've mentioned, the key to keeping a tolerable stress response from tipping over into the toxic stress zone is the presence of a buffering adult to adequately mitigate the impact of the stressor. In the case of rat pups, it's the mom's licking and grooming. In the case of a human, it could be a dad hugging and listening. The buffer is hugely important, not just to attenuate the stress hormones, but also to prevent the kind of epigenetic changes that lead to a dysregulated stress response and the major health issues that come with it. But I still had some questions. We know that a rat pup whose mom was a low licker could likely have lifelong problems with the regulation of its stress response. And we also know that an overactive stress response can set off a cascade of changes to neurologic, endocrine, and immune function. But on the level of DNA, how does that chronic stress affect the likelihood of getting certain diseases like cancer? After looking at how changes to the epigenome could be passed down from generation to generation, I wondered if higher risks for particular diseases became embedded as well. Was there some part of the DNA that got changed by stress and permanently turned on the genes for disease? Or was there something else going on? It wasn't until I stumbled into the wild world of telomeres that I saw there was more than one way to reprogram DNA. It'll probably be no surprise that the only thing I love more than a badass scientist is a badass woman scientist. So you can imagine my excitement when I found out about a dynamic duo right in my own backyard. I was first introduced to the work of Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn and Dr. Alyssa Epple of UCSF by a friend who has many lovely qualities, but also happens to be a little obsessed with premature aging. When it comes to aging, I tend to ignore the chatter and stick with clean living and night cream. But when my friend dropped the words chromosomes and premature cell death into the conversation about the latest anti-aging news item, my ears perked up. Turns out, this is one legit scientific discovery in the quest to understand the aging process. Dr. Blackburn is one of three scientists who received the Nobel Prize for discovering how telomeres, the sequences on the ends of chromosomes, work to protect DNA from the kind of damage that can lead to premature aging and death. Blackburn teamed up with health psychologist Alyssa Epple, and the two took off on a research tear, exploring how exactly telomeres can be shortened or damaged, and more important, how to stop it. Blackburn and Epple looked at how food, exercise, and even mental focus affected the health of telomeres. But to me, the most interesting part of what they found was that stress had a major impact on the length and health of telomeres, and that in turn had a major impact on the risk of disease. Let's back up a second. So what exactly are telomeres again? Sequences? It always helps me to think of telomeres as the bumpers on the ends of DNA strands. Telomeres are non-coding sequences that for a long time no one thought much about. They don't make proteins, and at first glance, aren't super active in the body. But researchers discovered that they actually do serve a vital purpose. Telomeres protect DNA strands, making sure that every time it's replicated by cells, the copy is true to the original. Telomeres are very sensitive to the environment, which means that like good car bumpers, they always take the first hit. Anything biochemically harmful, like stress, is going to damage the telomeres much more than the DNA. When the telomeres are hurt, they send signals to the rest of the cell, letting it know that the bumpers have taken too many hits and that the cell should respond. The cell reacts in two major ways. The first is that when telomeres get too short, too many bad parallel parkers in the neighborhood, the cell can become senescent, which is a sciencey word for old. This means the cell retires and doesn't do its job anymore. Take collagen, the protein in skin that makes it supple and prevents wrinkles. If too many of the fibroblast cells that are supposed to be making collagen hit the road to play shuffleboard in Del Boca Vista, you're left looking a decade older than you actually are. Lots of things can damage telomeres and lead to premature cellular aging. But chronic stress is a big one. When a cell becomes old or dies, it's not the end of the world. But if there's too much cell death in one place, it can lead to poor health. For instance, if there's too much cell death in the pancreas, you won't be able to make enough insulin, which can lead to diabetes. The response a cell can have to damaged and shortened telomeres, other than senescence, is that it can become precancerous or cancerous. When that happens, it means the ability of the cell to copy its DNA correctly has been compromised, and it begins coding for mutations that say, "Keep making cells forever!" This causes cells to replicate uncontrollably and grow into a tumor that continues to grow and grow and grow. Simply put, if there's too much damage to your telomeres and they become excessively shortened, it can lead to premature cellular aging and disease or cancer. This adds yet another fun variable to the dating game. Not too far into the future, ladies might start looking for partners with long telomeres. Research on telomeres and stress is relatively new, but we do know that early childhood adversity predicts shorter telomeres in adults.